Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Going back to this idea of women losing their desire, especially when it's tied to duty, I do get quite a bit of men, especially on my blog, who talk about being in a sexless marriage, where they're having sex many times less than 10 times a year, many times for years have gone without any sexual encounter and the frustration that goes along with that. And I see this issue is complicated in the sense that because we are in a benevolent patriarchy, which is good in a sense, mm-hmm. better than a full-blown patriarchy, these men are not, you know, forcing themselves. Of course, they're not being coercive. They're not being manipulative. They're very much respecting their wife's desire not to have sex, and yet they're completely feeling basically abandoned, you know, in their sexual intimacy, and it affects, of course, the rest of their marriage as well. So, with this idea of how do you help women kind of navigate this idea of compromise, which can easily go down the slope of duty, to also realizing, you know, how do we meet both of the needs in this partnership?
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of easy answers for this. I wish there were, because it's such a heartbreaking problem. I think that that in the realm of a sexless marriage, I would first say that accommodation of that sexless stance is not is often undertaken thinking that eventually she will see what a nice guy I am and how much I've tolerated her anxieties about sex, and she will eventually turn to me, be more comfortable, feel more accepted, and you know, that we will eventually have this thing that she says she also wants but never gets around to wanting. I do think that the more that the higher desire partner goes into a stance of accommodation, the less that things get mobilized or looked at or move forward, because part of the way that she's managing her anxiety is to keep the marriage sexless, or to keep it very, very limited amount of sex. And so she's not looking to really resolve it. It's kind of resolved for her. So usually it's the one who wants sex more that has to really instigate a process or an examination of what's happening. I think that meeting in the middle, as in, you know, you need to do it a few more times a year so that he's happy, doesn't really work, because this isn't what the men or the higher desire people really want. What they really want is a soulful engagement with their spouse. It's not that they just want her to give it up more frequently. They want to connect with her in this emotional, spiritual way. And I think that what that requires is that she's able to bring, with the lower desire partner, or she, if we're going to go with the stereotype, needs to bring more of her whole self to that interaction and to trust it. And I think that you can't, unless the lower desire partner really wants to do that work and wants to reclaim this part of themselves and reinvest in this relationship that has been more comfortable for them to disengage from, there's not going to be any real progress. When someone's coming to therapy because they know he's really had it and they want to just kind of say, you know, I really want it and I'm trying and I want you to just believe that and then leave me alone, nothing's going to change. I mean, she's really got to want it for herself, I think, for something to ultimately shift in the marriage. And I was just going to say, it puts the higher desire partner in a difficult position, because it is dependent upon how much she wants to shift it. You know, it's not, if it's really going to be something that's much more bonding for the two of them. And, you know, a lot of times it is about looking at what's happening in the larger relationship to understand what's inhibiting her desire, what undermines it, what are the things that he might be doing that interfere with the space that she needs. Because oftentimes the higher desire partner, his desire dominates the relationship so much that there's no room for her to want. It's always about managing this kind of constant pressure. And the more he feels like she doesn't want it, the more he desires it, the more that desire, that longing sort of sits on the relationship in a way that's oppressive to her sexual desire.
It's that cycle again.
Yes, that cycle, exactly.
Yes, that feeds upon itself.
Yeah, so it's really about breaking those cycles and helping people regulate their own feelings more within themselves so that they're, again, that differentiation that you talked about, so that they're more able to engage in their partnership in a more authentic way, in a way that allows more space for one another. So.
Yeah, and I think that this is where patriarchy also is a disservice and marginalizes men, because I think part of the message of patriarchy is that men are the sexual beings. And so then women are left feeling like, well, that's all they care about. Yeah. All he wants is sex. And the man is left really not looked at as a whole. You know, he's just kind of, he's objectified now as this kind of sexual beast. And that's the only thing that matters. And I think there's some very interesting research coming out showing that even when men have sex, if it's not emotionally attached, it's unsatisfying for them as well.
Absolutely.
And so that's really blowing, you know, the top off of all these assumptions that I think we as women sometimes make. Along with that, what I'm finding too that many of these men are writing in about in this situation is that their women, their wives have tied sexuality very much to the idea of procreation and having children. And so while they were having children, you know, they would be willing to be sexual. Now they've hit their 50s or their 60s and no longer see a purpose for sexuality and are kind of hiding behind, again, the marginalization of, well, again, you're carnal. That's all you care about. You're somehow beneath me because you still care about this.
Right. Absolutely. So I think it's really sad when men get reduced to, you know, being hormonal, natural man taking over, you know, this is all they think about, and not seeing behind that the longing, the desire that's healthy, that's important, that's about really feeling bonded as a couple. And, you know, I think similar to what you were saying, I think that, you know, many people come in and they say, I had so much desire before we got married, as if there's news to that, meaning so many people come in and say, I had it all then we got married and it was all gone. What's the matter? What happened? And I would say the context of pre-marriage and the context of marriage are vastly different contexts. And that is, premaritally, we have all of the space to desire. You know, love is in the wanting. You don't quite have the person yet. You don't know if they really love you, if they really care about you. There's structural distance. He drops you off. He goes back to his apartment. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of space to want. You know, there is still an adventure ahead of you to see if you're going to ultimately conquer this person or not. Once you've conquered. So what I would say is your sexual desire is happening to you in that context. It's like a hormonally drenched state with enormous amounts of fantasy about who the other person is.
Which is not always reality.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it's a state of mind that really fosters sexual desire. Once you get married, that structural distance is gone. He's lying there next to you naked with just his socks on. It's not that enticing, right? So it's, you know, it's, can you want what you already have, as one theorist talks about it. And I think that, you know, the challenge in marital sexuality is that in order, you have to really foster it and nurture desire, because it's not going to happen to you anymore. But in order to do that, you have to really be comfortable with being a sexual being. You have to be comfortable with introducing sexual novelty. We have to be comfortable talking about what turns you on and what appeals to you, and feel like I can share it and it doesn't make me a bad woman.
And be playful. And
I can be playful. I can have pleasure. And all this is an important part of being married and being human and being whole. And that's
the biggest lie there is, okay, so therefore there must be something wrong in my relationship. So I'll leave this relationship and go look for another one. And then it repeats the whole same thing you've said, that, yeah, of course, at first it's very exciting. It's, again, that whole you want what you can't have or what you don't yet have. And then yet you marry that second person and you're finding yourself in the same situation. So
right.
I always say, do you want to figure this out with Joe or Brian or do you want? You're going to have to figure it out. But
right.
So who do you want to figure it out with?
Exactly.
Right. Not that I want, I mean, it's not always that simple, but that's,
yeah,
that's kind
but
of...
absolutely, that's what I often say to couples is they're facing the difficulties of the marriage and saying, you know, you have an opportunity to learn, you know, to grow up essentially, to learn how to be more whole as a person and to be more differentiated and to know how to really love another person. And you, and it's painful, but part of that pain is an important part of the growth process. And, you know, you can do it now or you can go leave this relationship and do that work with someone else, but it is work that you need to do.
Right. Okay, so within, I think, LDS culture, there's still a stigma of going to a mental health professional, although that's becoming less so. So, but added to that, then going to a sex therapist, I think, is even, you know, five steps even further.
Yes.
So, I often hear concerns from people about going to therapy in general, you know, that if, especially if they're not LDS, that they're going to somehow not respect my values or take my values into consideration. I think with sex therapy, people are very much concerned that they will be introduced to things that they don't even want to think about, or that they'll be asked to do things that they don't agree with, such as masturbation, looking at pornography, exploring fantasies, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your take on the whole sex therapy field? I know you're not necessarily a certified sex therapist, but you're mm-hmm. definitely doing mm-hmm. what would right, be considered some sex therapy. So,
mm-hmm. Right. Like, yes, I would say that what I look at is the sort of interpersonal and psychological elements that inhibit and foster good sexual relationships. But, you know, in terms of, I understand that anxiety, and I think that's partly why Mormons tend to want to go to a Mormon therapist, is they're really anxious, especially in the realm of sexuality, about what we've often learned is the debauchery and chaos that's outside of of the church. And so we can be really anxious, and anxious that someone's not going to respect our values or understand them or devalue them. And what I would say is that I think that's, you know, legitimate to be have concerns about it. I think when you find a good therapist, they a way of knowing that they're good is that they really understand the cultural context from which you are operating, and not only are they understanding of it and seek to understand it so that they can understand what your challenges mean to you, but they're also seeking to understand it so they can use it as a resource for you also. And that's just good practice. And if someone's not hearing what your perspectives are and how you feel, then it means they may not be so great. Like one person said to me, she went into a therapist and offered her coffee, and then they were a couple, and they said, well, no, we don't drink coffee, we're LDS, this is part of, you know, why we're coming, we're having challenges in this way. And every week he would offer coffee over and over, which was to say he wasn't picking up on, no, you know, we're saying to you that we are different and we need you to hear it and understand it. And so needless to say, he wasn't a very sensitive therapist to who they were. So I think there's reason to trust that you can get good help outside of the church, but you also want to be aware of how in tune they are with who you are and what you're struggling with and what you're comfortable with doing or not doing.
And I think that's the catch-22 that both the therapist and the client are in, because as therapists, part of our job is to challenge people, you know, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, if you say, for instance, well, I'm uncomfortable with that, therefore we can't even mm-hmm. discuss that. That's not really the therapist, right. You know, the therapist is going to want to explore that, you know, well, why are you uncomfortable? And
yes.
are those good reasons to be uncomfortable, or
yes.
is that healthy? And there are things that people are uncomfortable with that really aren't that healthy.
Right.
And so I think that's the catch-22 people find themselves in. I often find LDS both individuals and couples coming to see me and saying, oh, yes, I came to see you because my last therapist said
yes.
this, and I couldn't
yes.
believe they said it. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, well, I would say that, too. So I'm like, okay, yes. now where do we
right.
go from here? So
yeah, no, you're right. And I think being LDS, you're really at an advantage because you can, you know, the structure of the faith so well that you can find those healthier constructs within it, you know, using the spirit to guide your decisions, understanding mother in heaven or the body and its celebration in the church, that as a non-LDS therapist, you just wouldn't know how to look for those healthier themes right within the church to help people embrace them more completely. So
right,
so
and then they can't discount you as quickly, I think, you know, because if it's a non-LDS therapist who's telling you anything along those lines, you can say, well, they're not LDS, so they don't understand.
Yep.
Whereas
right.
I think with an LDS therapist, all of a sudden you're having to say, oh, well, this person's within my faith structure and they're looking at this differently than I would, and so why is that? Or so that's maybe
right.
one of the pros of seeing an LDS therapist. There's cons too. So I mean, there's there's definitely pros and cons to everything.
Yes.
Okay, so going back to sex therapy in particular, what are your thoughts about some of the sex therapy things that maybe would be considered more controversial within LDS culture, such as you know, having a couple use manual stimulation to help with issues anywhere from anorgasmia to erectile dysfunction to whatever?
Well, I guess I would say I think that it's important if it's what a couple needs. I mean, I think if you hold that your goal is a comfortable, functional sexual relationship between a couple, because my personal belief is that's extremely important, then whatever assistance a couple may need to achieve that is certainly open to consider in my mind, or at least that I will bring it up for a couple to think about if they're comfortable with it and if they think it would be helpful to them. You know, for some women who aren't able to achieve orgasm, it's because their anxiety is just simply too high in the context of the relationship and because they don't know what it is that they need. And so in some cases I've, you know, suggested that women take time alone to get to know their own body's capacity for orgasm and arousal and so on, and to do it without the husband there. And, you know, that's only if they both feel comfortable with that idea theologically, or that they don't feel that it's somehow sinful to do that. But, you know, again, I'm always saying that justifying it in the frame of it blessing your marital relationship. And how can you help a spouse know what you need if you don't know what it is you need? So I think it's not only is it like okay, I think it's extremely important to know your own body, to embrace your own body, to know what it is that it's capable of, and then from there to be able to bring that into a loving relationship. You have to know yourself first in all respects.
Yeah, and I love the term you use of that being relationality, that, you know, that self-stimulation, masturbation, however people want to term that word, is in the context of relationality can be a very useful tool.
Yes.
And I think
Absolutely. Also
this idea that we have in our own doctrinal type of teachings, that sexuality is very clear in the manuals that that's between a man and a woman. And as long as, you know, neither are feeling coerced or forced into anything or are, you know, deeply uncomfortable with something, that
right. You
can be, whatever it is you decide to do and to use as a couple is up to you and your
right. Spouse.
Right.
Absolutely. So, and you know, I actually gave a presentation in a Relief Society once and made the horrible mistake of, in response to a anonymous question about what to do if you've never had an orgasm, I basically gave that as the response, and it there was a bit of a stir. but you know, because that can be distressing for people. But you know, I read in a book that called "And They Are Not Ashamed," I think that's the name of it, by Laura Brotherson. She refers to self-stimulation as, I think, self-educating. It's very delicate the way she approaches it, but she's basically saying women really need to know their own bodies before they can help their husbands know what it is that they need to be aroused and to achieve orgasm. So, you know, I think it's fully legitimate and important.
Yeah, and again, in the context of not being within secrecy and shame, I think where masturbation can become such an issue in marriages is
yes.
when one person is, you know, falling into that behavior without the other person knowing, and then that person yes. feels betrayed, and trust issues ensue, and, you know, ongoing, yeah. ongoing. So
exactly. And so exactly. I make a distinction between that and someone who's secretively looking at pornography and masturbating as a way of, you know, bringing their sexuality outside of the relationship and in a way that's destructive to the relationship. So absolutely. I make a real distinction with people around that.
Right. And that goes back to your relationality, that anything that has to do with bringing you closer together and can be part of what I like to call your sexual repertoire.
Exactly.
So,
yes.
What about this issue that we don't tend to look at women who maybe are the ones who are looking at pornography, or women who have the higher sex drive, that so many women, I think, that are in these positions can feel so marginalized and so alone, or even feel the words that I get on my blog is I feel freakish. I feel weird.
Right.
What's wrong with me?
Yeah, right. Well, absolutely. So there's this way in which the culture doesn't name, consistent with, you know, my dissertation, is this idea that we don't own that women are sexual. And so we almost deny that women could have sexual challenges in the sense of, you know, being sex addicts or having any of those kinds of problems. But of course, then when women are the ones that are the higher desire partner or are tempted by pornography or whatever, it's like a double whammy. It's like they know that it must not be right because it's not right for the men, and yet it's not even being spoken about. And so how do you even say to your bishop that you're having trouble with this? Because it means you're off the charts weird. And I think that's really unfortunate because, you know, men and women are sexual beings, and some women are, you know, I think I read a statistic that said in 25% of marriages, women are the higher desire partner. I know a theorist that I read, David Schnarch, in his experience, it's half and half, that he has the experience that half of the couples that come in, the woman's the higher desire partner. But people just don't talk about it. And so the stereotypes persist. I think I said this earlier in the interview, my experience is that it's always the higher desire partner is the man in most of the couples I've seen. But I also wonder, because of the shame going both directions, not just for the women for being the higher desire partner, but also for the men and being the low desire partner, because it's so inconsistent with their notions of what they're supposed to be. So they may reach out for help less frequently.
Right. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit earlier. You mentioned David Schnark, and he has written Passionate Marriage, which is a book I highly recommend. It has some material in it that I could see some LDS couples may be uncomfortable with, but I think overall it's a fabulous book.
Yes, right. And he makes his central premise is that marriage is the best context for the most soulful sex, because here is a realm in which you can bring your whole self and really challenge yourself to grow. And so I think that, as you say, there's a lot of his assumptions are consistent with LDS assumptions.
Right. Yeah, he's just very upfront about how he talks about it.
Yes, he is.
Very blunt.
Yeah.
Other thing I was going to ask too, then, kind of along the lines of, you know, using masturbation or self-stimulation within the relational aspect of the marriage, is that sometimes I find this to be helpful even with the drive issues, that mm-hmm. if the couple can say, you know what, yeah, I'm not really in the mood, but I understand you're in the mood, so let's work through this where you're able to do mm-hmm. that for yourself, but within the context of my being available emotionally, or mm-hmm. Whether I'm right. at your side when you do that, or I just know you're doing that, and this yeah. sometimes can take off the pressure of having to have similar sex drives, which is practically impossible.
Yes, I fully support that idea. I mean, I know in my dissertation research, some women specifically said that they felt that was wrong, and I think that's something people say in the church a lot, because it's not relational. But I disagree that it's not relational. It's a functional use of masturbation to enhance the comfort in the couple.
And I think it can be a quite erotic experience to watch, or to be willing to allow your spouse to watch that process. That's a pretty intimate, vulnerable position to be in.
Yes. Absolutely.
And when people say they're uncomfortable with that, that's one of those examples I would say, well, I think the discomfort there is you're uncomfortable with your vulnerability, which that's the kind of discomfort you want to challenge.
That's right. I fully agree. Absolutely.
So what about your thoughts about erotica versus pornography?
You know, I don't have strong, well-articulated thoughts on this, so let me see where I go with it. I guess what I would say is that I think in a couple, what's important is thinking about what allows me to feel sexual, to feel turned on. You know, that encouraging desire may very well be important for me, especially if I'm the lower desire partner. And thinking about what are the ways that I can encourage that I, you know, if I can hold as a premise that being sexual and being able to engage in this language of love and affection and play with my spouse is good, what are the supports that I need to help me move into that realm? And I think there's quite a range for men and women in terms of what they need and what allows them to do it. And, you know, in speaking about fantasy, I think fantasy can be, you know, the whole range of, you know, I want them to come in and help the kids and then just touch me but not have any pressure and walk past me and then go work on the dishes. And, you know, they can have these whole scenarios that are highly erotic for them, this idea of being taken care of and his desire not being too dominant and him being a little elusive and all this. And then there's people who have fantasies where they really want to be dominated and they want him to be the powerful, you know, character in the sexual interaction. And you know, they want to be tied up. You know, there's all these kinds of things that people will want. And I think, you know, that it's okay to bring that into the couple and to think about what does that mean and how does that help me? There's one couple that I've worked with where he needed no fantasy. I mean, his only fantasy was to be sexual with her, which was largely in the fantasy realm when I first started working with them. And her fantasies were much more, she had a lot more need to be lifted out of the mundane and the everyday. She just had a hard time feeling sexual when, you know, there were toys on the floor and she could hear the, you know, baby in the other room. And so he, you know, they're a good LDS couple, and so on, but he started, he found something online called Lusty Library, and he would download these stories and he would read her a bedtime story, and this was extremely helpful for her. And these were, you know, just stories that would arouse her, that would allow her to sort of move into a different realm with him. And the way he would read it to her, it was just a total turn on for her and extremely helpful. And it was actually really brought, she talked a lot about feeling closer to him for being willing to be this flexible with her and to sort of engage in something that she really needed, and that for so long in the marriage she'd felt defective for not being able to
elicit her own arousal.
Yes, exactly. And so to feel teamed up with him and to feel that they had an alliance around this, that, you know, that they were helping each other, and this meant an enormous amount to her. And as their sexual relationship was improving, even though she was, you know, they were getting regular downloads from Lusty Library.
I love it.
They were coming together more and more emotionally and physically.
So, right.
So I guess I would say I don't have like one stance on it. I would say I remain open to it. I do think that one of the challenges with pornography is that it's sort of snuffed out our sexual imaginations in a lot of ways. And does have a lot of problems associated with it, especially the secrecy and the ways in which it's used as an escape from the relationship. I guess I would say, in general, I'm not a big fan of pornography, but I would say that I'm open to the ways in which couples can use outside sources to facilitate connection between them. But I'm a big fan of sex being about connection, intimacy, sharing of your whole self, including your erotic mind, and including those things that you feel uncomfortable with within yourself even, and having it really be safe to be with one another in this way.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I agree with you. I'm not a big fan of pornography either, especially even just from the industry standpoint and, yes. and some of the stories that, you know, circulate around that. But you know, I think erotica can be such a broader subject, you know, from poetry to, you know, like you're saying, literature to even music.
Yes.
There's so many things that can just elicit those feelings of natural arousal that don't need to fall, I think, into the realm of pornography. I think sometimes, however, in the LDS church, we struggle with knowing how to create that line between yes. those two, and sometimes we unfortunately don't enjoy a lot of good erotica that I think is valuable because we put it into the realm of pornography. What about sexual toys, vibrators, dildos, you know, lubricants, massage oils, all these different kinds of things that people can use also as tools? What are your thoughts about that?
You know, again, I would, you know, I'm going to sound redundant. I would say the same thing. I mean, if I'm holding as the central premise of whatever couples need to be able to feel sexual and to be together in this way and to feel a deepening of their alliance, a deepening of their bond, I think then all of that is open for consideration. And, you know, that part of it is that couples... how to say it. I think part of the challenge of a good sexual relationship is managing that maybe people have differences where someone wants to introduce something like a vibrator and the other one feels very uncomfortable with it. And trying to navigate those differences and understanding what it means to each person and how much do you stretch yourself and how much do you simply set a limit and say, I'm not willing to introduce something into what we have. And I think those are just individual challenges, meaning individual to a couple, yeah, to each couple, to navigate and to sort out between themselves and or with a therapist.
Right. Yeah, I think that's that ongoing compromise is yes. obviously important. Well, why don't you bring us home with some closing thoughts and just kind of, you know, what would be maybe your, if you could only say a few things, what would be the main themes that you'd yeah. like to leave us with?
Well, I guess that I'm very grateful for the gift of sexuality. I think it's a wonderful resource for us and underutilized in our faith. And this gift from God is highly underutilized to bring couples together, to enhance their lives, to help them feel deeply bonded with the person that they love and that they've committed their lives to. And, you know, that I really hope to be a part of helping more couples have that as a resource in their lives. And, you know, I certainly hope that that shifts within the church in general also, that we can celebrate it more openly and not be so afraid of sexuality.
Using and really our own doctrinal themes.
Yes.
Which I think are very pro-sex.
That's right. And giving that to our children at the same time that we really are helping them navigate a highly sexualized culture that really gives distorted notions of sexuality, in my opinion. So on the one hand, I think sex has the possibility of being a very beautiful, sacred experience between couples. And what makes it beautiful and sacred is this ability to fully share your whole self with another person, to take that kind of healthy risk and to have it be met. That's what makes sex beautiful. But you can do all kinds of things with sex and you can make it horrible. I mean, it can be destructive and highly damaging. And so we really need the message that it has the potential to be an amazing thing, but it also has the potential to really be hurtful. So we have to handle it with a lot of wisdom. And kids need parents' guidance. And if parents are so anxious that they have the talk and they're not able to stay in an ongoing conversation with their children, they're doing them a deep disservice, not preparing them to manage the pressures through adolescence, but also not preparing them to manage the realities of a marriage. And it's just, we need to do a better job as parents and teachers in the church.
Yeah, so the concept of opposition in all things, I think, is what you were first referring to with both the beauties and the struggles that sexuality can bring. And then this idea of, I think we do focus so much on adolescent sexuality when we are parenting, right. And yet we miss out. I mean, that's really only, what, 5 to 10 years of their lives, and how about the rest of the 40 years? You know, are we preparing them for that?
That's right.
So, well, this has been a fabulous interview, and I could keep on talking to you forever, but and maybe we'll have you back sometime if I can get you to do that. Can you tell us what you're currently offering and how we can use you as a resource? How can people contact you? Tell us about your website.
Sure. So my website is www.finlayson-fife.com. And then I also have a blog where I just advertise online courses that I teach. I teach 1 6-week class on enhancing your relationship. It's 1 hour, it's a little over an hour every week. And then I also teach another course on enhancing your sexual relationship. And I will be offering that one and this relationship class in January again. So that's in my blog, which is, and maybe you can link to this because I think it's Dr.
Yeah, we'll link to everything.
Yeah, drjenniferfife.blogspot.com.
Okay. And then is your dissertation available for sale if people want to read that?
It is. If people will contact me at jennifer@finlaysonfife.com, then I can direct them to how to purchase it.
Okay. Because, yeah, I think it's a great read, and if anybody's interested in that, I think it would be worth the time getting that.
Oh, I was going to say, I think most parents don't read their children's dissertation, but my mom, it was a page turner for her.
Yeah, it was
chapter 4, because of all women talking about their experiences. It's not as hard to read as some dissertations.
Right. No, it was very well done. And I'd like to throw out to the listeners the option of submitting questions or comments or topics that they might, you know, want us to address in the future. Or interested in discussing that have to do maybe with this topic, and I can let you know what we come up with. But I'd just like to thank you so much for your time. This has been very educational, very productive, and you've just done a wonderful job. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Natasha. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.